thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week this show will address many ways of creating greater health, joy, and love for you and those you care about. We're going to introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows, or many if you'd like, to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we make a positive difference together. Now, I want you to know that I am grateful that you take your time to listen to, or in some cases, watch the show, and especially those who are sending in questions, comments, reviews, and suggestions, because please remember, this show exists for you. Now, I was told that I haven't mentioned this enough, so here goes. If you haven't gotten your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal yet, please go to our website at answers.network and download a copy. Give it 21 days and comment on whatever platform you listen to us on, what focusing on gratitude has meant for you and your loved ones. And if you'd like to send them to us, go ahead, send it into our website, and I will read some of them on the air. Now, as many of you know, if you've listened to this show, you know that I believe that one of the best ways for us to make a positive difference in the world is to focus on love, gratitude, and finding your own path to making a difference in the lives of others. Well, our guest today is certainly doing that. She is Ellen Shute. And she is a renowned practitioner, consultant, and educator with a lifelong commitment to empowering individuals, families, and teams. Now, doesn't that sound like what we're after? So as the president of Empowerment Partners of Bingham Farms, Ellen has transformed countless lives through her work as a clinical social worker, providing psychotherapy to individuals, couples, and families. She has also been an adjunct lecturer at the University of Michigan School of Social Work since 1998, sharing her expertise with future generations of professionals. Now, Ellen's extensive experience includes conducting educational workshops for mental health professionals, covering critical areas such as trauma, social work ethics, relationships, family development, domestic abuse, and divorce. Now, she's been recognized for her outstanding contributions in many ways. She was honored as the with the prestigious Mandel L. and Madeline H. Berman Award for Outstanding Professional Service in 2010. Her expertise and insights have made her a sought-after expert in the field, leading to regular appearances in print and broadcast media. Now, with her wealth of experience and passion for empowering individuals, Ellen continues to make a lasting and positive difference in the lives of countless people. Now, through her groundbreaking workbook, What Drives You? How Our Family Dynamics Shape the People We Become, she invites readers to embark on a transformative journey of self-discovery, unlocking the secrets of their past to shape a brighter future. Ellen, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to speaking with you and your audience today.
Well, we've already had some questions that have been sent in. And I know that, and I listened to your podcast, which, by the way, at some point, I want to make sure that we mention that as well. It was interesting that you have, you know, it's called What Drives You. And, yes. And I know that you talk a lot about being in the car, you know, the things that we do in our car, you know, going on family trips and things like that. Let's talk a little bit about how this ties together.
Sure. So I use the metaphor of a car to represent a family. And whether you grew up with a family that actually had a car or not is kind of irrelevant. This is just a metaphor. We all grow up within the confines of this metaphorical car. And everyone in the family has their particular seat in the car, and every car has its rules, and every person in the family has its role to play in the car while we're growing up. The car, this unit or car, takes all of us in the family from one day to the next day to the next day. While the children are developing, while everybody's getting older, and the car keeps us in a solidified position where we are engaged with each other, involved with each other, and there's a dynamic interaction of people between each other. And in my opinion, it is that interaction in our cars every day that helps to shape our personalities. It helps to shape how we think, what we do, how we view other people. It's the most powerful influence, I believe, other than our own DNA, but it's the most powerful influence to us that we have in our lives. And many of us think that, well, we grow up with our family and then we leave our families, but we always take a lot of that car with us, even though most of us leave our families of origin only to create our own car or several cars after. In many ways, we still hold on to that person who we were in that seat in our car growing up.
Well, as an example, how did this metaphor resonate with your own family experiences?
Right. So it was my family experience that really set me to wondering about families in general when I was a little girl. So I was, my mother and father got married immediately after the Second World War, and they had me as a baby. And when I was a young baby, 18 months old as a baby, my parents actually got divorced, and my father moved out of state, married someone else. And I really had very, very little contact with him after that. But my mother went on also to get remarried. And the person that she remarried is the person that I really think of as my father. He's the one that was there during my childhood and adolescence and for the rest of my life. And he did ultimately legally adopt me, but that really wouldn't have mattered. He was who I thought of as my father. So in our car, if you think about the car metaphor, I was raised in a family where there was a father in the driver's seat and a mother in the passenger seat in the front, and me as the child was in the back seat, okay? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, when I was 18 months old, that driver was gone. In those days, it wasn't something that you talked through with your children, and especially not an 18-month-old baby. But what happened after he was gone, my mother was single mm-hmm. until I was 7. And so basically, she moved into the driver's seat of our car, and I moved up to the front seat to be with her. And mm-hmm. it was her and I together for 7 years. And then she got married again. And so if you think about my seat in the car, I went from the back seat to the front seat to the back seat again. Yes, as my father who raised me sat in the driver's seat and my mother was in the front passenger seat. Now, what I would say to you about that is that even though my mother was in the front passenger seat, she really told my father every move to make in the driver's seat and probably was the driver of the car, even though she didn't sit in that seat. And every car has their rules. And mm-hmm. sometimes the rules are spoken, like we don't scream and yell in this car. And sometimes mm-hmm. the rules are not spoken, but they're delivered through body language, messaging, right. punishment, things like that. But in my car, the rule was spoken. And the primary rule in my car was that little girls are to be seen and not heard. And other women of my generation shake their heads vigorously when I say that, because it was a very common belief then that little girls were to be seen and not heard. So my role in my car growing up was to be in the back seat by myself. In my car, the second rule was that you always had to look pretty. So I was sitting in the back seat trying to be a good girl. I didn't bother anybody. I didn't need anything. I just tried to go along, to get along, look pretty so my parents would be proud of me. And that was my role in the car.
Now, were you an only child the whole time?
It turned out that I was an only child the whole time. My parents did try to have more children, but were unsuccessful at that. So I was an only child. And I do firmly believe that had there been someone else back there with me, it would have looked very different. But because there wasn't, I just sat in the back and I was a good girl. And so I learned how to not have a voice. I learned how to keep things to myself. I learned how to take care of what I needed on my own. I learned all kinds of stuff, that much of which has been really helpful for me, and some of which has really held me back in my adult life. And I'll get to that. But when we're talking about how I came up with this metaphor, so I know the interesting thing about our little family was that coincidentally, each of my parents were also only children, which meant that not only did I not have siblings, but there were no aunts or uncles or cousins or extended family. So it was really just the three of us in my childhood existence. But I always had lots. Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, now the thought that comes to mind to me when you're saying that is that if they both were also only children, do you think that they somehow felt that that was completely normal because of the fact that they were raised the same way? So why wouldn't it be completely normal for you to grow up in kind of alone in the back seat type of thing? Do you think that that had a bearing on it?
I think absolutely that had a bearing on them not really tuned into my experience of it, because they were used to that. They were probably also in the back seat of their own cars. Right. I do believe that it was pure biology that they didn't have more children, because I know that they wanted more children. My mother had many miscarriages that I remember growing up. So it definitely, everything in the car affects us. Doesn't have to be bad, but it has an effect on us.
You know, this is something I have never thought of until having this conversation with you, but I spent the majority of my youth and probably my younger adult years with almost an inability to be in the back seat, to the point that I would get motion sickness. I mean, I would get sick. And yet, if I sat in the front seat, I wouldn't. Just that difference of sitting in the front seat versus the back seat. And I've never thought of it like this before until I'm thinking about what you're talking about. And I'm wondering if that was something that I was manifesting, you know, for I guess however it was that I was feeling when I'm in the back.
It's very possible. I think that a lot of people get sick in the back and not in the front. However, I do believe that when we would talk about you and your childhood, and I would ask you where your seat was in the car, it would probably be either in the front. Was it in the middle of two parents, or was it in one parent and you in the front?
Well, and it started out, you know, I'm the oldest. And so it started out being in the middle between the parents. And then my brother came, and then we were both put in the back. So now we were both in the back, unless, you know, I was going somewhere one-on-one with my dad. So if he was going to, you know, if he was going to take me to a ball game or something like that, If it was one-on-one, now I'm back in the front seat again. So anyway, it was interesting that, again, until you know, reading your workbook and speaking with you, I hadn't really put that much thought into this, but it's got me thinking now.
that right there is exactly the point. When I ask people who sat where in their car, usually I start with, so who was in the driver's seat of your car? And they'll say to me, oh, my mom, oh, my dad. And I'll say, was the other parent in the car? And they'll say, oh, yeah. And I say, where were they? And I've gotten answers like, in the trunk. They were in another car riding along the side of us. And it's wow. just the images of those families of how this person experienced their family is so powerful to help us understand that person's experience and how it might have felt to them to be in their car. Because as children, the truth doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is our truth, our perception of what's going on. And we learn who we are and make assumptions all on the basis of that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about family roles and either in your family car or in some of the experiences from people you've worked with.
Yes.
How does the where you were in the car type of thing translate later on to you know, somebody who becomes the funny one or the smart one or the troublemaker or the peacemaker?
Right. So that's a really good question. The role in the car is really just to keep the car going. Okay. Mm-hmm. And every car has various roles. The thing about children's roles is that we somehow as humans instinctively know from infancy that we're going to try to be something that isn't already in this car. So if the first child is the, you know, overachieving perfect one, the second child is not going to be that. The second child could be a difficult one. It could be the nicest one, the easiest one in the family. Or the funniest one. Absolutely.
Now, see, this to me brings up a whole nother thought as it relates to birth order, because there's so many things, and I was just having a conversation about birth order. There's so many things that through psychology and stuff has been put at as birth order, saying, well, it's, you know, this person becomes this and that. I think you're adding another dynamic to this, to where maybe it isn't, it's just a coincidence that the birth order person becomes this, but could it also be where they sat in the car?
100% it is where they sat in the car. Birth order matters because the first child gets to pick one. And the way that children pick their roles, and this is also from infancy, is by trying something out and seeing if it gets reinforced. So if the first one tries out being the good child, they're going to keep doing it. But when the second child is born and they try out being the good child, they don't get any attention for it because the first one's already getting that attention. So the second child is going to try to do something different. And this is all unconscious, just pure human instinct. The second child is going to try to do something else to get noticed. Every child wants to get noticed, wants to be important, wants to matter, wants to know that they are a factor in this family. And some children do that with positive seeking things. Some children do that with negative seeking things. Some children do it because they're the sick one, or they're the needy one in some kind, in some way. Some children do it by being perfectly satisfied. They don't need much attention from anybody, but in the inside, they're really feeling not so good about themselves because everybody around mm-hmm. them seems like they're getting attention. Mm-hmm. So it's different in every family, but I will tell you, when I work with people, that we're always the difficult one in the family. And I would ask them, so your older sibling, your older sister, was she the good and perfect one? And invariably they say, oh yeah, for sure. And I could never keep up to her. So everybody chooses a role that is unique to them. Some of the roles that have the most life-lasting effects is when someone's role is to be the pleaser or the fixer or the funny one. And the reason why people do that as children is because they find that when they're smiling a lot and don't seem to need too much, that everybody's happier and it makes their environment better. So they keep doing it. But many roles turn out to be oppressive as adults. It's hard to live your life as the pleaser.
Well, and let's discuss that. So let's discuss, somebody has assumed a role.
Yes.
And let's talk about sort of the change and growth of it, because your book suggests that while our childhood identities drive us, we can learn to steer in a new direction. So can you share some instances where either you consciously deviated or somebody you've worked with has consciously deviated from a childhood identity that was part of their growth as a person?
Yes. So I can share many, many situations, but I'll start with my own story. Okay. So I was the girl that grew up that didn't have a voice, that wasn't allowed to have a voice. And my entire adult life has been about putting myself in places where my voice is going to be valued. I'm an educator. I'm a therapist. I'm a public speaker. All these places where people are basically paying money to hear my voice, which is the only way that I knew would guarantee that I would be able to have a voice. As I have gotten older and have children and grandchildren and husband, I have learned to use my voice in many ways, but also there's nothing that you could do or say to me right now where I would lash out at you. I that's just not in me. It was taken from me. I'm not able to do it. So I did develop a voice. I have developed a voice over my lifetime. My husband, on the other hand, who is also a really good example, is the youngest of five boys. And in his car growing up, this was literal and figurative, his car, they had one of those old station wagons where the back seat was turned around to the outside of the car. So the back seat faced out. And mm-hmm. when I asked him where his seat was in the car, that was his seat. In the back seat, waving at the people in the cars around him.
Behind them, yes.
Yes, right. And if you would meet my husband today, he would come at you in just the same way. He learned to be very friendly. He learned to engage people outside of the car in order for him to get noticed. And that's still very, very much what he does. My husband is also a social worker and an educator and all those things. And he had his family history was filled with a lot of grave difficulty. But I believe that we have the power to not be what we don't want to be. But I say that it's either going to come naturally to us to do what we've always done, but with intention, we can decide to make changes. And our adult changes out of our original roles are always intentional.
We're speaking with Ellen Shute, and the book is called What Drives You? And we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like Ellen to tell us a little bit about our brain development and how it's influenced by our family dynamics. So for everybody out there, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practice lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. Our guest is clinical social worker and educator, Ellen Shute. And when we went to break, I asked, how is our brain development influenced by our family dynamics?
So I'm gonna explain our brain development in a clinical social work way.
Good.
Our brain develops and grows throughout our lifetime. When we are born, the part of our brain that is fully developed is the brain stem or the reptilian part of our brain. And with the brain stem, our behavioral responses to things are either fight or flight responses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As we grow older, more parts of our brain develop. And actually, the prefrontal cortex part of our brain, the part that does all of our executive function, that understands consequences, that is able to think through things, that's not just black and white, but more in the gray, that part of our brain is not necessarily fully formed until we're in our mid-20s. So the whole development process in this car, our brain is developing. Now, the problem, there's good things and bad things about that. It's great for our brain to continue to develop. But what we understand is that our own personal experience in the car is going to affect the way that our brain develops. So if we grow up in a car where we feel like we don't matter, like no one is paying attention to us, in a car where we can't depend on somebody to be there for us if we need them, in a car where people are not, don't seem to care about how we feel about things, in a car that is parent-centric instead of child-centric, we can develop very, very negative beliefs about ourselves, our worth, our value, our lovability, and we can develop negative beliefs about other people, that we can't count on them, that they're not dependable, that they don't take care of us, that they don't care about us. Those things that I just mentioned are all parts of what we know to be trauma. And when we grow up in a car where there is this kind of emotional trauma going on, and our way of handling it is to think that it's because we're bad, which is what all children do, or because other people aren't to be trusted or relied upon, we will have what's called disrupted neurodevelopment. Which will mean that our brains will actually form in a traumatized way, which means that as we grow, we will have less ability to soothe our own emotions, that when things upset us, we're going to really get upset. And we also will have a hard time returning back to a normal state after we have been triggered emotionally. And those things are, yes.
Right. No, go ahead.
Those things are because of the way that our brain developed. And we're kind of stuck with that for the rest of our lives. We can help it, we can change it, but I have people saying to me, I'm too sensitive. And I know that when they say that to me, it means that they have deep wounds inside and that when something happens to them, it really hurts. So it's very much related to our brain development.
Now you mentioned an adult-centric car or a child-centric car.
Right.
What would you say is a good balance and how does a, say, young couple, how do they start out doing this and get the best possible results or the best possible situation for themselves and their children?
It's a great question. So the very, very most important thing in a car is when parents understand their children's emotional states. Mm-hmm. So that means that if something happens that a parent is saying to a child, wow, how was that for you? What did that feel like for you? Where the parent is encouraging constantly, just asking about a child's emotional state, what we call validating the child's emotional state. And it's something that really can happen from birth. The way mm-hmm. that we validate infants, small infants, is by tending to them.
Right.
When an infant cries, the infant needs something. And crying is the only vehicle that they have. And maybe they don't need to be changed. And maybe they don't need to eat. But maybe they do just need to be held. Mm-hmm. And it's a commitment, especially during the first year, in my opinion, to try to respond as much as you can to a needy baby. And I know that that can lead to many sleepless nights. But when the parent responds adequately to a new baby, a secure attachment is formed. And that secure attachment can really change the entire trajectory of a human being's life. So
what I was going to say, what I'm getting from that is that make that child or, as they're growing up, make them feel as mentally and physically safe as possible. And talk a little bit about the two different things, how you can traumatize somebody by not making them feel physically safe, but you can also traumatize them by not feeling mentally safe.
Right. So physically safe, I think most people understand that, although I will tell you, I was at the mall the other day and there was a woman ahead of me going up an escalator with her, looked like 2-year-old, 2.5-year-old child. Mm-hmm. And the woman grabs the arm and the child is just left to get on this escalator fending for themselves. That would be physical safety, that you extend your hand, you help the child. But emotional safety is a whole other thing. I would encourage people to watch a very specific, very quick video on TV called the Still Face Experiment. This okay. is an experiment with a mother and a baby who is about 1 year old. And the mother is interacting with the baby, and then they ask the mother to sit there in front of the baby and not respond, just have a blank face, a still face. Mm-hmm. And you see this baby the baby tries to get the mother to look at her. She squeals, she squeaks, she points, and the mother is just there, even though she's there physically. There is mm-hmm. physical safety. And this goes on for a minute or 2 minutes, and the baby just completely folds over into sobs, because to that baby, that moment feels like life or death. When our child is beckoning us, and as parents, we're busy, we're doing a million things. We have all this stuff going on. It's impossible to respond every single time to a child that wants us. But when we do respond, we could say something like, oh boy, I was so busy, but I'm here. What do you need? Kind of thing. That my favorite example of this is, and many people have, you've been behind a parent and a child in a grocery cart in the checkout line. And the child sees the candy over there and the child wants the candy, okay? And the parents have a variety of responses to that. Some parents say, no, we're not having candy. We're not buying candy. Some parents say, what? You don't want candy. We're going home and having dinner. It's not time for candy. And some parent, the validating response is, that candy looks good, doesn't it? But we're not going to get it right now because we're going home to have dinner. So in one case, we tell the child, it's okay to want it.
Right.
Right. But we're not getting it. But when we try to tell the child, you're bad for wanting it, or you shouldn't want it. If you were to say to your partner or anybody that loved you, that is such a beautiful whatever over there, and they were to look at you and say, that's ridiculous. Why do you think that? I mean, it's silly, you know?
Right. And in both situations, you're invalidating whatever it is that they are feeling at that moment. Just makes no sense. Yeah.
Well, the sense that it does make is that for many parents, they don't really want to hear the child's emotions. They themselves don't express emotion. They don't want the child to have any. Things are much tidier and cleaner when we just don't have any feelings. Yeah. In my book, I talk about four different kinds of families, and the real family where people are encouraged to express their feelings when they're sad, when something's wrong. The real families are messy. They're not neat and clean and perfect. They're not little girls sitting in the back seat looking nice and not saying anything. Real families deal with the hard stuff of life. They decide that we're going to talk through it rather than one day you having to act that out. So many of us were not raised in real families because at that time, nobody was a real family. Everybody just did what they should. But now real families are really what has to be in order for children to live and have their feelings in this very, very difficult, complex world we live in.
Well, we've got about 9 minutes left, but what I would love for you to do is to touch on a little bit about these four types of families. And because I think there's many people out there that are going to identify with one of them.
Yes.
And if you can not only tell them a little bit about it, but then for those that identify with it, be able to share something. If it's a very positive thing, then that's great. You know, we're telling people keep doing it. But if there's something negative there, what's something that they can do that's going to shift that and make it become more positive?
Yes, right. So I start with the disconnected family. Mm-hmm. And I when I talk about these families, it can be any socioeconomic group. It can be a two-parent family. It can be a divorced family. It can be a one-parent family. That there's no demographic delineator. These types apply to everyone. In the disconnected family, the parent is often trying very, very hard to provide for the physical needs of their children, but not necessarily the emotional needs of their children. And these are families that just put out today's fire today and move on to tomorrow and put out tomorrow's fire tomorrow. Nobody has goals. Nobody talks things through. There's not opportunities to kind of learn from what happened yesterday. And it's just whatever life is coming at me at the moment, we're going to deal with. children in disconnected families, and I've worked with many disconnected families with significant financial resources where both parents are out of the house working, making money all day, and the kids are kind of left to fend for themselves. Very often an older spouse will be the one to remind a younger spouse about their homework or something like that. But the thing that's missing from these families, there's tons of really good, successful families where both parents work full time. Sure. But you still need to be, your children still need to depend on you. You can't, when you come home from work, have used all of yourself up in that time. It has nothing to do with how much people are working, and much more to do with how the children feel that you are there for them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So that's the disconnected family. The next family is what I call the perfect family. Now, I grew up in a perfect family. We all did exactly what we should. Every family's ideas of should are different based on their culture, based on all kinds of stuff. But I learned growing up that if you just did the right thing and married the right person and all these things, that life would be wonderful. And there were no feelings allowed in my family, none. I never, ever, the whole time I was growing up, saw my mother cry. I also never saw my mother without makeup on, because before anybody would see her, she would be dressed and beautiful first thing in the morning. And that's how my family was. Perfectly coiffed, beautiful clothes, and that's what we did, and we thought that would be enough. If my parents were still alive, they would have very little appreciation of this life I have created for myself right now, because it just was not what they thought I should do.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting that you're using the word should. And one of the things that I know helped me is when I realized that I needed to stop shooting on myself.
Right, exactly. That's a phrase I use all the time. Yeah. But, you know, even if we don't say it out loud, it lives in that hamster wheel of negative voices that we have in our head. And everybody's shoulds are about different things, depending on what your family taught you. Yes. So if you grew up in a perfect family, or if you're trying to raise a perfect family, I just would say to give yourself some grace. And maybe the first step is to acknowledge to yourself what you're really feeling. Right. You don't have to tell anybody, but when you grow up not allowed to have feelings, it's really hard to have them as an adult. And it's hard to let your child, your children have them, because you're just uncomfortable with them. Okay.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. I talk about the real family. Excuse me. The real family is a family where there's no feeling that's out of bounds. We can talk about anything. Yeah. In the real family, we can say what we feel, but the real family is led by a parent or two parents that are generally equal, and both have impact on the family, and both step into the driver's seat when it's most appropriate. Each one of them does. In the real family, the key to the real family is respect and expression. We can talk about what we need to talk about with respect to other people. We learn about other people, about compassion. We come to understand that people have less than us or more than us, but that we're still worthwhile. All of those kinds of things happen in the real family. I always talk about real families being messy. In a perfect family, kids get into the car after school and the parent might say, how was your day? And the kids will say, fine. And that's kind of the end of the discussion. In the messy family, this kid gets into the car and starts to cry, and that kid gets into the car and starts screaming at this kid for crying. And the parent is able to try to bring everybody back to the moment and talk through what needs to be talked through. That's the real family. That is the goal. The other unfortunate family is, so the disconnected family has no one in charge. The next level up is a family where there is one person in charge who very much might be a dictator, who thinks that that person knows how every person in the family is supposed to act and think and feel and believe. That's also a family that doesn't allow for real feelings. The theme of that family is fear. And when you grow up in a family of fear, it's really easy to automatically, we do what was done to us. It's very easy to grow up and automatically think I need to be in charge. Even I need to be in charge and do it differently. But in the real family, it's more of a democracy between the parents. Mm-hmm. And there is not a dictator. And the goal is for everyone in the family to be heard.
You bring up a good, when you mentioned about the dictator and, yes, and people carrying that on, I don't know if there's percentages or anything, but do you find that there are more people that try to carry that same thing because that's all they know? Or do you find an equal amount of people that rebel 180 degrees against it and then essentially make no decisions?
Yes. Well, what I would say is I've worked with many people that grew up with a dictator and hated having a dictator. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right.
What they learned with the dictator was generally how to be a pleaser.
Okay.
And how to, and I try to give people a lot of credit for that because it was a life-saving, what we call maladaptive behavior. At the time it was adaptive. But as an adult, to always need to be a pleaser to make your situation safe is hard to do and usually not, and oftentimes not helpful. I won't say usually, I'm a pleaser. It's worked for me a lot of the time. I'm a huge pleaser.
I can relate.
Yes, but but I would say that one of the, I've done a lot of work in the area of domestic violence, excuse me, and the single biggest risk factor for a boy growing up in a home with a violent father is that he will just automatically model that behavior. When you grow up with an angry parent, especially a boy with a father, you learn that that's how you deal with difficulty is by, mm-hmm. by being angry. So that's something that I would say. But I've worked with many people that had angry mothers, angry fathers, and said at some point in my life, I knew I was never, ever going to do that to my kids. I would say I've had more of those than the other.
The book is called What Drives You. Ellen, unfortunately, we have run out of time. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, best places to get the book, what are some other things you'd like to share?
On my website, ellenyshute.com, you can buy the book on the website. You can listen to my podcast on the website. Amazon is the best way to find What Drives You, but you can also order it through any local place you get your books. And it is an easy read, but a very, very powerful book that will help you to understand yourself and those people in your family in a much more compassionate way, and to be able to be more intentional about how you want to live as an adult.
Very well said, and I second that. I agree that it's an easy read. It's in sort of a workbook format, so
yes,
that you constantly feel like you're growing, and that was the feeling. And so again, for anybody out there. We'll make sure that all of the information is also on our site, answers.network, so you'll get the right spellings and everything to be able to
Great.
Find Ellen on the website and to be able to order the book. Ellen, thank you so much, and not just for coming on the show and talking about this, but for putting out a book that really is, it's a workbook of how you can improve your life and the life of all of your family members.
Thank you, Alan. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Now, for everybody out there, I'd like you to join us the next 2 weeks, okay? So not just next week, but the next 2 weeks, because we're going to have an Answers Network holiday special. We've got two episodes that truly embrace the mission of this show. One, for its ability to help couples who are struggling in their relationship to find the reset button and regain the passion that brought them together. The other, for showing us how improving our immune system can be the single most important thing we can do to improve our overall health and longevity. So on December 25th, we will feature the show that we did with Chris Parsons. And his book is The Healthy, Happy Marriage Reset. And it was awarded to that show because it got the most comments in 2023 from you, our viewers and listeners. And on this show and in his book, Chris guides us one step at a time into an exciting, innovative strategy to heal your relationship and elevate it to new heights you hadn't even imagined were possible. Now, on January 1st, 2024, our New Year's show will feature the show that we did with Dr. Michael J. Shea and his book, The Biodynamics of the Immune System. It was awarded to this show because it was the most downloaded show from the platforms that you find Answers Network on. But Michael explains how the five-element theory of Eastern medicine offers a method to reclaim our body and how, in order to enact the full benefits of the immune system, we need to nurture a deep sense of safety inside our own body. Now, I believe that the doctor of the future will prescribe for many people an enthusiastic social life, strength training, a high protein and good fats diet, hydration, grounding, sun exposure, and 10,000 steps a day. And one of the greatest gifts that you can give your family and the world is a healthy you, which is a very good way to start the new year. So from all of us at Answers Network, wishing you great health, incredible joy, and continued blessings for this holiday and the season beyond. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.